Well, hi everybody and welcome. This is Dave. For our final seminar, I wanted to begin by looking at some questions that I'm not sure I totally covered and want to do a brief overview of them now and then see if there are other follow-up or related questions you have. There were some questions sent in or responses sent in initially about being able to explain the benefits of using neuroscience in coaching or to reason a way out of a negative cycle or guide someone out of past repetitions. Now, the premise, remember, that we began with is that many of the methods to facilitate change are contrary to the way our minds and brain work. So I think showing rather than telling will always work better. And that means, for example, to do a sample session and to give someone the experience of effectiveness of working with you in a focused way, or a brief initial discussion to look at what their challenges are. Let me give you an example. It's a simple study that illustrates why someone can't change with just new information or facts. And you guys know I look for these, the simplest but significant studies. One example is how we learn to ride a bicycle. Dr. Dustin Sandler built a bicycle reversing the engineering so that when the handlebars turned left, it would automatically go right and vice versa. This seemed like a really simple thing to do with a basic concept that is one and done situation. You want to go left, you steer right. Cognitive understanding of simply reversing the usual routine was significantly challenging, though. And he did this first on himself. Just knowing cognitively was totally insufficient to suddenly rewire his motor responses. He had to unlearn one schema and learn another to replace it. He found that he couldn't simply add another schema, just reverse the turn, and have that be enough. It took him several weeks, almost 2 months, of daily practice to unlearn the old automatic response and learn the new focused one. So a schema is simply a pattern to organize information and then to create an output channel. For him, it was simply to ride the bicycle in a different way. It becomes operative when we learn a new schema and unlearn an old schema. So new learning is always attendant with unlearning at the same time. And the repetition of this simply was not enough in and of itself, initially at least. When he reversed the bicycle, knowing what to do didn't change his brain. So here's another. This study goes way back, and I'm interested in your thoughts and questions, and I'll stop talking in just a minute, but I thought these both illustrated a response to a number of your questions, and I appreciate you guys sending those in. This is kind of an analogy of a focus and what goes unnoticed is analogous to the 90-95% of our operating system that's unconscious. So think about that as you listen to this. This is from 1804. The Swiss physician, Ignaz Troxler, found that by staring at a central point in an entire field of blobs, ultimately everything except the center point of focus disappears. The Troxler effect also applies to an unnoticed point in peripheral vision that will ultimately become invisible if it's not noticed. Our visual brain is always seeking motion and change. Anything not noticed ultimately becomes invisible. Our system doesn't notice something that doesn't change. Things that don't change get ignored. So this is simply one thing to think about when you ask a client what they want to focus on, because you're bringing that issue into central focus and changing the process from just a usual elaboration and spontaneous discussion and conversational patterns to a specific focus. That's different in itself. That is unique to the coaching conversation in the way that you develop the coaching story. And remember, again, from my initial discussion in Seminar 1. So I hope this sort of answers some questions and gives an illustration and a working model of that. Before we begin our final seminar, any thoughts or questions or additions that you have that we could discuss just briefly and be helpful to you? Well, I'll reserve some time then at the end of our discussion to be sure, jot down anything you want to come back to and talk about. So hold on and I'll put us on lecture mode. Okay, we're going to talk about sustaining and extending change and especially transformative success. To initially talk about how to handle change and navigation of transformation, because this is something that in and of itself that you and your clients may need to address when they get beyond what they have experienced before and there's no operating models that they can rely on. And if they do rely on those, like any intuition, it may use outdated software. So this is something to think about how do you sustain and extend success? Because the thinking, often of the client, maybe even us at times, is about getting to that goal, to that endpoint of success. This is going beyond that. Angela Duckworth, and you may recognize her name from a book that I think is really useful for coaches called Grit. She studied children and adults in various really challenging settings. And in every setting, she asked the question, who is successful here and why? One characteristic she found that prevailed as the ultimate predictor of success is grit. She defines grit as passion and perseverance for long-term goals. Her conclusion, this is a quote, we have to be willing to fail, to be wrong, to start over again with lessons learned. Often the first step of a decline in any endeavor is a loss of perspective. So a fundamental principle of grit is a growth mindset, a belief that the ability to learn and improve is not fixed, but can evolve with dedicated effort and deliberate practice. Growth mindset to build grit. This was originally developed at Stanford by Dr. Carol Dweck. Growth mindset is a belief that the ability to learn and succeed is not fixed and can evolve with effort and systematic practice. Dweck has shown that when people read and learn about the brain, and this may be an answer to how can this be helpful in your practices, that when people read and learn about the brain and how the brain can change and grow in response to informed challenge, people are much more likely to persevere because they don't believe that failure is a permanent condition. We have, and translated, that means that when our clients reach their goal, we may choose to nudge them and ask, and what else? Or is there more that you want to do? And they will still need you for that, because getting to the top of the mountain is not the same as sustaining and extending that success once you're there. So we engage hope for a new experience. Yet, as every step ahead for each client, experience the pull of the old, repeat, because that's familiar, and that's the default mode, and that's easier, as well as the trepidation of the new, and that's each step into the beyond where they've been territory. A remarkable success introduces the challenge of something the client hasn't quite experienced yet. Think about your experience in this. Think about a remarkable success. Nothing is really that familiar. We don't maybe have stories to rely on to organize and understand a categorically new happening. No models, no repetitions to rely on for continuity and understanding. Now, through these unique experiences and the resultant success, there's no memory, no past experience to activate, no brain patterns to rely on as default modes of operating. The conclusions from prior actions and experiences become, in a way, insignificant or peripheral, and even can be limiting. Remembrances become irrelevant. Faced with these new challenges, experience and memory can be like a museum. Intuition can be using outdated simulation, outdated software. So, for this, to talk about identity challenges and transformative experiences, think of a specific example, maybe of yourself, maybe of a client. With a major change, an identity paralysis can possibly occur, feeling stuck in a way that these new events don't fit with your sense of self. The more sudden and the greater a departure from previous experience and identity, the more likely it is to challenge the fundamental sense of self. Then, sudden identity challenge has been studied in situations ranging from windfalls, like lottery winners, retirement of professional athletes and executives, as well as attempts to move from a stigmatized identity, like former prisoners. Identity paralysis is based in established neural wiring and patterns suddenly challenged with the need and possibility of change. To deal with a major life change that can move beyond former identity, some strategies have been known to be helpful. And I want to talk about those just briefly. First, and this may be most challenging, do nothing until you have a plan. Think about some major success that you've had. And you may not have had a windfall in a lottery, but think about your biggest success that may have been unprecedented. Use that as a model. After doing nothing, create a distinct marker to break from the past, like some specific event or symbolic representation of the end of the chapter and the beginning of the new, to begin integrating past and present into a new, current, different story. Identify the transformation steps. That requires metabolization of past experiences and identity into a new form. You're not who you were before. You're not yet where you're going to be in terms of identity, and you're in the middle, and that's not comfortable. An evolving new identity becomes authentic based on a bedrock of needs and ideals applied and integrated into new endeavors and synthesized into a story, a purpose that can easily be conveyed to yourself and to others, though that's not necessary. The idea of consolidating and solidifying that simple basic game plan is what's significant. So let's look at the internal compass of that, of what we expect and what we predict. We rely on our experiences to make sense of the world and to predict what we next expect. With something that's categorically new, an unprecedented experience beyond where we've been before, you know that you don't know and recognize that there are outcomes you can't be aware of exactly. So it makes it a little hard to focus on what you do know. While there are some aspects of actual experiences, think of unprecedented experiences that come from success, the accompaniments like fame, power, wealth, influence. You still have the fundamentals of your sense of self to guide decisions. You experience no limits, no guardrails, when previously there were limits that weren't even apparent as limits. You couldn't afford it, so you didn't buy it. Now there are no limits. There are no options. If suddenly there are parameters that no longer apply because there are a lot of options never before experienced that you didn't realize how much you relied on the default assumptions, well, you just couldn't, you know, spend the summer and on a tropical island somewhere, you had to work. Maybe a week, maybe 2 weeks. The discoveries of new awareness may inspire creative responses. New possibilities require the need for new models and to understand and process, mainly to self-regulate first, then to plan. These new lived experiences can be transformative. Or these fundamental components of self and identity can be rejected instead to use an old model, an existing model to fit these experiences into, which may disallow growth and creativity. So to rationally formulate a decision and consider potential consequences, especially at a time of success, reflect on a time at some point in the future to look back on your decision right now. These are questions we talked about in Seminar 1, but I want to revisit them. What will you be glad at a specific time, 6 months, a year, 2 years, that you decided to do? What's your worth outside your achievement? What is your identity beyond the recognition you get? Is your worth in metrics of intrinsic value and contribution rather than in money or accolades? What about decision-making in situations where there's no prior experience of the different outcomes? Without this awareness, choosing among possible paths or even hypothesizing different paths, calculated and expected value of different choices may be anchored in your current model, in your current experiences. So there are still ways to enhance the rationality and possibility of choices and actions. A potential internal compass can be to reflect on any previous similar situation and successful navigation, analogous to bright spots that we talked about. Internally, there are needs, ideals, and purpose built on a foundation of core identity to inform choices. These options can allow continuity of a sense of self independent of what external situations and stimulation and successes there are. Now, there are a couple of downsides to this pattern. When our experiences match our predictions, we most often don't question or examine them. It's a fit. It's a done deal. And when we have never had experiences to inform understanding and response, the result can be to feel lost. Again, as we've discussed, our intuition and prediction are based fundamentally on our expectations using our current models. Our cumulative experiences have created algorithms to generate a model to perceive, to anticipate and make sense of things, and from that we predict what to expect. This interpretation becomes determined by the existing models and dynamic situations, not just what we perceive, but also how we process and decide. So let's look at how to assess change experiences, to look at models, maybe even questions. I'll refer you, if you haven't seen it, my last blog, it's at my website, MentorPath, and the last tab on the upper right is blog. The last blog is called The Vampire Problem, and I'm going to discuss an application of that here. The act of imagining is simply not enough to inform what it may really be like to be blind, a slave, a Canadian goose, or a vampire. These experiences, including extreme success, require decisions that cannot be ceded to logic, to scientific inquiry, or to previous experience. There's no normative standard to frame or anchor a life-changing decision that also changes the future. So how can you assess or help a client assess a future experience, draw from information, some of which is not available yet, and learn from similar experiences also not known? No first-order experiences may be available for a new success paradigm. What others have done in a similar situation may be interesting, but it's from their individual and family and social system network that gives it meaning in those contexts, not yours. What model can then be used for these categorically new sets of experiences? Consider your internal framework of experiences from before, the foundation of your needs and ideals, and how you can attune to core issues by first regulating states of mind. This process of fundamental self-regulation to first ground and center yourself allows access to information in all of your states of mind in this searching position. So before any content or any questions about what you decide, this is the first question of how do you decide. Get grounded and centered first because you need access to all the information, even though some of it's outdated. So this also allows you to stay aligned with your core identity and then apply a growth mindset to sustain and enhance exactly what you've done to generate the sets of achievements. Notice how this process addresses how not to get lost in an elated or otherwise reactive mind state determined by the successes rather than determined by your fundamental operating system that got you there. So a new structure of information, necessarily abstract and not from direct experience, would ideally inform in some ways without explicit knowledge and direct experience first. A new structure can guide when it's aligned with needs and ideals in a fundamental way to begin incorporating new knowledge and preferences. It's hard to create a model of experience based on abstraction. Perhaps one basic approach would be to reflect on previous experiences that were exceptionally stimulating due to their novelty, something beyond what you imagine, some specific thing. The impact of this direct experience and the personal tools that you use to process and master this experience could be a beginning. So for you. Think about your first response to these questions. What's the most recent successful experience beyond what you imagined? What personal tools did you use or create to get there and to deal with it? What was, of all of those, the best practice that you used to create, the best practice you created? And think of this. Who will you become in making the choice you consider? Every important decision needs to be grounded in your identity. So let's look at one aspect of decision making. We touched on this, but I want to go back to it. A part of many decisions is the consideration of optimal stopping. When do you need to stop considering all the options and make a decision? Algorithms of everyday life engage considerations of optimum stopping for any ongoing endeavor, from looking for a house, a new assistant, any other choice, when at some point you have to stop considering and decide. There's a really interesting book. I reread it to talk to you guys. Computer scientists have addressed algorithms for these things, which can be complex and evidence-based. Brian Christian, Tom Griffith's book, Algorithms to Live By, The Computer Science of Human Decisions, indicate that over time, every decision becomes an optimal stopping issue. There's always a factor of time in decision-making. This aspect of time can turn any decision-making to include optimal stopping, choosing the specific time to make the decision. You hear a client, for example, well, you know, I decided to start this Friday, but I got to that point, and then I'm really going to get with it Tuesday. So you want to listen for if there's any internal bargaining. You want to listen for if there are any limiting assumptions or limiting beliefs that a client may use to put off the decision or in some compromising way. Over a dozen studies on optimal stopping all reveal that the most common mistake is that people stop too early. And that, of course, makes sense because that forecloses consideration and discomfort and the work of the cognitive dissonance. That's why a client wants and why we all want just to give a client a suggestion, because it forecloses discussion and exploration. For example, one inevitable optimal stopping decision is retirement. The hard part for the athlete, the executive, the professional, the worker, is to recognize when that is. Not too soon, not too late. How do you decide? You still can keep going. There's not a mandatory retirement age. A significant component of ending a very successful run of achievements in business, sports, the arts, or any other endeavor is confronting how much the performer, the experience, the purpose, as well as the accompanying aspects of the achievements have become part of an identity. Possible models to make rational decisions under significant stimulation and stress may be useful to consider. One strategy is to rely on the merits and strength of known approaches to inform possible outcomes. An important beginning may be, in certain situations, to consider a new decision previously unexperienced is to recognize that you cannot make that decision based on outcomes and responses you've had previously. It's unprecedented. For example, novel chess players can't see the sequence and patterns several moves ahead that the master of chess can employ. You can't assign probability to future moves since you don't know the pattern. But you can determine immediate and expected alternatives and their value to your game plan and identity. What aspects are relevant? What information do you have to make a choice that can sustain success, that you won't regret? This approach frames current decisions rather than by comparisons of detail and prior situations in terms of core needs and values now and in the future, and the cost and value of each decision made. Any transformative experience will likely not be made by evaluating either prior experiences or current subjective possibilities. Lived experience may offer little information. Current needs and ideals, your own values, can begin a foundation to begin consideration of. Rational and authentic must pair with core identity in any decision made. So, what can you focus on to consider possibilities in the face of significant change, and especially a transformative experience? First, initial mastery of self-regulation and states of mind to balance the stimulation of emotion and the temptation to respond impulsively. Second, clarity and loyalty to a foundation of personal identity, needs and ideals that form a bedrock sense of self. And third, shift perspective. A year from now, 5 years from now, look back to what you'll be glad you have done or have. To begin with knowing that the immediate alternative to being swept up in an emotionally induced state of mind, especially of excitement, of endless possibility, is to develop a model of decision making. This development of a guide for balanced choice at this time of transition can generate a fundamental framework, and that becomes you, the mentor coach, the guide for these times in people's lives, a new model, and the most fundamental reflection and question, ultimately, will it work? Subjective value is independent from experiences of pleasure, happiness, even pain. A transformative experience requires you to recognize, own, and assess the choice architecture of each decision in a plan, then to map those responses, to author new experiences, and then program new identity. Note that these 7 steps are the roadmap system, the acronym roadmap for what we've already discussed. Recognize, own, assess, decide after mapping, author new experiences, and program new identity. Now, this is for us. This is not an exercise to get the clients, in my view, but this is for helping inform us in a systematic way to collaboratively guide and work with someone. Focus on the decision model can generate awareness of a decision process rather than simply succumbing to the excited state of unlimited possibilities without precedent. So, focus on the decision model rather than a subjective state of mind can be initially grounded and oriented. So, a usual decision involves a process to consider options. Perhaps, if it's an important decision, creating a mental simulation of what it might be like in order to assign value and priority to make a choice. Transformative experiences may not be able to rely on automatic processes or even these questions if there are no existing mental models. Many of our life choices are ones we make without actually knowing what it's like to make that choice. To be married, to have a baby. A survey on Facebook asked people to list the most notable life experiences that they had as a first time without having any prior experience, whether chosen or unchosen. There were a broad range of responses. You decide to have a baby there before experiencing what it's like to be a parent or have a child. You're informed by a number of parallel experiences of being in a family, knowing others who had a baby, experiencing firsthand when a family member, especially parents, have a baby. Similarly, perhaps, other first-time experiences, miscarriage, chemotherapy, divorce, a life-threatening infection. And regardless of research and examination, you cannot possibly make an informed choice if someone gives you the option of being a vampire. We have no model for some of these, especially these previously not experienced. No precise description, even at the time, for the experiences that are so engaging and so ineffable that even sometimes words aren't important enough. So for those experiences that are so new and so categorically different, we may still be able to stay centered and grounded, and especially if they hire you as a mentor coach, self-reflect and self-regulate to make balanced decisions without knowing the outcome, but only knowing a part of that foundation, identity. The core concept of identity will be subjected to a growth mindset in itself to evolve and flexibly adapt. We've talked about how we do that in mentor coaching to help someone evolve stepwise and transform the model of how and who they are to incorporate the changes into their operating system. This is what makes it permanent, because we always return to our identity. Unless we address that in coaching, then someone will revert to where they were before, most likely. Perhaps consideration in dealing with unprecedented experience is not knowing or guessing about the context of those situations at all, but of knowing yourself, staying loyal to yourself. No matter how much you plan, create logical models and anticipate, you may never be able to know what it's like to arrive at the pinnacle of success until you're actually there. This is the challenge. This is the opportunity to sustain and enhance success, to surpass even that pinnacle, to create a novel simulation in our brains based on known variables of available information. Still does not constitute lived experiences in these new situations. Consider the phenomenon of the hedonic treadmill. You experience pleasure and success and stepwise gradually accommodate to it, so it continually takes additional success to even sustain the same degree of pleasure. Daniel Kahneman termed this the hedonic treadmill. The gradual accommodation requires not just sustaining, but enhancing those experiences. The experience itself is transformative. It requires focus, adaptation, and a game plan to accommodate new experiences and identity and to keep it going. This transformative experience may elude any prediction, since prediction is based on cumulative experiences, most likely. This makes future expectation and projections elusive, if not impossible. In mentor coaching with a client who is experiencing remarkable success, that which exceeds even previous expectations, you and the client have to regularly deal with these enhanced experiences. A massive transformation involves redefinition and evolution of identity to incorporate the changes and the shifts due to the success itself. So let's look just a moment. I want to save some time for discussion and get any questions or comments. Let's look for just a moment at sustainable success. Marcus Aurelius hired a servant to walk behind him as he made his way through the Roman town square. And the servant's only job was to keep whispering in his ear when people praised him, "You're only a man. You're only a man." This was his externally enhanced self-regulation and grounding. After their first whirlwind tour of the United States, the Beatles returned to England and immediately set about working on and cutting their next album. In fact, they did a new album every 6 months. They didn't take time off to bask in victory or allow successes to derail their plans. Instead, they pressed their advantage and refused to let anything hijack their focus. Dr. Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, I will not be able to say it again, and I certainly can't spell it. You recognize his work, though. He's a pioneer in the field of positive psychology who also contributed to the study of creativity, and that's what I want to focus on here. Over the course of 50 years, he interviewed game-changing geniuses from diverse fields, inventors, artists, Nobel Prize-winning scientists, Pulitzer Prize-winning writers. He discovered that creative geniuses spent their time intensely pursuing an activity and then engaging in restoration and recovery. He found that this combination fosters breakthrough ideas and discovery and prevents creative burnout and cognitive fatigue. So there is a common process to look at it, to zoom out for just a moment, to look at developmental steps here. A common process among outstanding intellectuals, creative performers, three developmental steps. The first is emerging, when there's total engagement in their work. The second developmental phase, incubation, a period of rest and recovery, when they don't think about their work. And then insight, new ideas and growth in their thinking to reengage the process. Tough decisions and challenging mental tasks actually deplete energy and cognitive sharpness. Fatigue from one task can spill over to another. For example, when someone exerts self-control, the prefrontal cortex activity diminishes, and this mental draining can decrease then subsequent self-control. The brain works much like the body. After lifting weights to the point of fatigue, arm muscles don't function as well. Likewise, after you've used your mind to the point of fatigue, it won't function quite so well. So the important thing is this fatigue can lead you to give up on solving tough intellectual problems or other challenges. The growth equation is to balance stress and rest and recovery. Maintaining success in any field is often at least as challenging than achieving that success in the first place. So once you achieve the pinnacle, how do you sustain passion to continue the cycle of mental and physical endurance to continue to excel? We now know that resilience, even to sustain the experience of peak performance, can be measured and taught. Creating success is a significant challenge, but sustaining success and staying at the top can be an even greater challenge. Elite performers are not distracted by either victories or failures of themselves or others, and instead focus on what they can determine. Elite performers become masters of mentalization. And this is practicing professionals like coaches, executives, physicians, performing professionals, athletes, actors, artists, consistently self-direct and inner focus during practice and performance. They rebound from setbacks and defeats and rely on intense focus on specific goals. They find ways to sustain effort and energy through small stepwise achievements with consistent focus on what's next. In other words, they develop a map, a system. This simple practice of decision neuroscience begins with the framework of mindset, and we can learn a great deal from the systematic focus on the next step, on the short-term goal, and from learning to visualize the experience of effectiveness and mastery while at the same time having an internal map of major events and goals. And if you're not a visual organizer, to write it down or to do something within your preferred style of best mental representation. Elite performers celebrate their accomplishments without losing focus on what comes next. The mindset of optimism frames the focus on what can be achieved. The sense of effectiveness comes from, I can do something about this. And that is a foundation for every decision. Any failure or setback can be reframed as an opportunity to learn and improve. And that's the response I wanted to give at the beginning of this seminar to some questions about how do you explain, how do you look at indicating to someone about the value of the mind and brain sciences. It's not about giving information. It's about showing. And this is with a sample session, with a brief discussion. Extraordinarily successful people achieve because they pursue excellence through purpose, passion, and deliberate practice. Most of them struggle more than the average person, even after they reach the top. If you look at someone and see their success, you're comparing your inside to their outside. That's not an apples-to-apples comparison. Often, the satisfaction of success comes not from achieving goals, but from engaging and pursuing them in a satisfying way. Those who achieve their dreams, whether athletes, performers, professional, business people, sustain happiness when they're able to focus on next and create and evolve a game plan. This is not an addiction. It's a growth mindset. It incorporates ideal achievement and contribution. A desire to evolve and contribute becomes a bedrock theme of gratifying and sustained achievement. So I want to preface what you have at the last part of your outline about resilience insurance. Because there are a number of things, and I'll just be brief about this because I want to keep the time for discussion and your comments and questions. A number of factors can tip the balance away from self-awareness and planning, even toward distraction or impulsivity. The imbalance can result in overspending, addictions, risk-taking, chokes, unforced errors. Understanding and planning can circumvent these issues and add to resilience. Awareness of factors that predispose to lowering the threshold to distractions and compromised decisions can be remedied to provide resilience insurance. And this is something that we can listen for. We're not educating clients about this. I wouldn't talk to a client. I'm just talking to you guys. But this is for your information to listen for and to facilitate awareness by asking questions and collaboratively pursuing. For resilience insurance, consider the importance, first, of energy management and self-regulation for best decision making. Any depletion of the energy or preoccupation of attention can compromise decision-making processes and outcomes. So here are some variables, and I just have the situation, I think, in the outline. I want to just explain very, very briefly, please. Consider these variables that can lower a threshold and the accompanying resilience that may compromise. First, depleted energy. When we become depleted for any reason, including a sustained exercise of willpower, a tired brain yields more readily to temptation or to impulse. When depleted, we tend to fall back on default mode and actions. We get triggered more quickly. I'm working with a challenging and very gratifying couple who have had all kinds of therapy, all kinds of coaching. We're working in coaching in couples work, and this was something that needed to be addressed as a foundation for each individual before we even began to consider the interface of the two. Secondly, lowered blood glucose levels. Here's a study. Some of you may have heard me talk about this before. 8 parole judges were studied for 3 years for their decision-making regarding applications for parole. The average parole rate among all the judges was 35% approval. The exact time the decision was made was studied in relation to the judge's 3 food breaks. They were doing 1 control variable, glucose. Morning break, lunch break, and afternoon break. After each meal, there was a 65% approval rate for parole. Just before lunch, just before the end of the day, corresponding with the lowest blood glucose level, there was almost 0 approval rate. And these cases were balanced for equality, for sameness. Another, emotional overwhelm. The stronger the emotion, the more likely we are to act impulsively. It ends the tension by creating a change, just like it ends the tension of exploration, the cognitive work, by giving a client a suggestion. Specific emotional triggers can instantly change a state of mind and generate emotionally driven reactions. Another, high demands of self-control and concentration. Activities that impose self-sustained control and concentration can become cognitively depleting and energy depleting and have the impact of drawing energy away from an emotional bank account. When that threshold is lowered, there's a greater chance to consider less, to make even impulsive decisions. Another, distraction. When we're distracted, we're more likely to lose focus on rational decision-making and react with a default pattern. A couple of researchers demonstrated that people succumb to temptation more frequently when the part of their brains that's in charge of deliberate thinking is specifically preoccupied or overloaded. It becomes like the peripheral dots of the Troxler effect that just sort of fade from awareness. Another, abundance of choices, choice paralysis. An excess of choices can overwhelm our bottom-up system to result in impulsivity or, at times, decision paralysis. Another, ineffectiveness or powerlessness as an experience. Then, if someone experiences helplessness or ineffectiveness, they often counter that by an action of anger or spending or eating or drinking as an attempt to begin to focus on something tangible and be effective in doing at least something, an action to change a feeling. For example, what do you think was the best day in the last several decades in the history of retail shops on Madison Avenue. Any guesses? I know you're on mute. So it was the day of the stock market crash in 2008. And the last one, unconscious biases. Emotional states can activate preset meanings of unconscious biases. An example here, a study of 16 years worth of case files of judges from LSU, Louisiana State University, found that judges gave significantly harsher sentences in the 2 days after LSU lost a football game it had been expected to win. So there's a summary of research for us to consider in mentor coaching that's in the outline that I won't go over now. But just as a final line, and this was, I think, the first question that I saw, neuroscience is essentially not a body of knowledge, but a systematic way of exploring. I hope that I've helped you consider some things that might be useful to you in what you're doing in mentor coaching. I'm going to take us off lecture mode so we can have a discussion. So, any questions, thoughts, clarifications, anything else that might be helpful for us to discuss? Would any of you share your most important takeaway from these four seminars together? Just in a very brief way, what's the most important thing you're taking away? This could be of interest to others. It's definitely of interest to me. Anybody dare to share that? If you wouldn't mind sharing, especially for those who are, a number of you are listening, will be listening to the recordings, I'll be interested in any questions, clarifications, anything else you'd like to share, but also especially your most important takeaway, and did this meet your expectations when I asked you those two questions at the beginning? And see if it met those expectations and what your experience of it was. I'm very interested. And if there are things that come up that you think of, fire an email. I'll be happy to respond to you. Anything else now that would be helpful for us to discuss in the last couple of minutes? Well, I really appreciate all the kind words and responses that you had in the beginning and throughout the series. All the talkers are doing it in emails. So I'm very grateful for that. I will mention something, and this is in response to some questions and some suggestions. I am in the process of putting together a training program through the NeuroMentor Institute of Peak Performance on the neuroscience of mentor coaching to apply the mind, brain, and performance sciences to navigate transformative changes. It will be a specially certified licensed training with 8 modules and 8 live webinars on Zoom. So I'm interested if you have thoughts. It'll be probably the beginning of late winter or spring before it's dropped, but I'll certainly, you'll certainly be on the first mailing list of that with your interest here and the responses and feedback you've given. So thank you very much. It's been a privilege to do this with you, and your feedback has helped shape some of my comments and discussion. I hope it's been helpful, and I welcome any responses. If there's any way I can be of help to you, please let me know. You have my email from my mailings and a way to sign up for a brief discussion if you'd like on my website. So thanks very, very much. I'll be eager to hear what you guys are up to And if there's any best takeaway or summary of what you're taking away that's been helpful, I welcome that. So thanks very, very much. Bye now.
Thanks, Steve.
Absolutely.